Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we will be discussing Alice in Wonderland. I am joined by Christian Murkowski, I believe it is.
It's pronounced from Umbridge.
I also have Kelly Wan. Kelly Wan, do you happen to have a tagline for us this week?
Yeah, the similarities between a raven and a writing desk, both make a mess if you put paper under them.
Huh? You gave that a lot more thought than the movie did.
I know.
Kelly Wan, can you break down for us what happens in Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland?
Oh, good. This is going to be good.
Yeah, there's this farm girl named Dorothy, and some special effects land on her house, and she becomes Queen of the Monkeys, and Davy Jones is in it. There's a bridge, and at the end, there's this Vorpal sword plus three water heater, chaotic neutral, 8-hit dice battle with Manticore.
Good.
And Johnny Depp turns into Colin Farrell. And you lost Avatar as Best Picture when I got home. Just in time. It was the best ending ever. Credits rolled. I stole my 3D glasses, which I guess are like bowling shoes now. They don't even like, you don't even get new wrapped ones. They just like clean off the old 3D glasses. You have to wear those.
Now, mine were actually wrapped in plastic.
Oh.
Must have gone to some dippy little theater. Mine had been sanitized and wrapped.
No, it's filthy. Mongrel races wear them.
In my theater, it said recycle to torrents, and we just dropped them in there.
Now, Kelly Wan, you neglected to mention that the heroine goes on to open trade with China, which
yes.
I thought was a fairly salient point.
Yes. That is a little-known historical fact that the Alice of Alice in Wonderland went on, because no one had thought of trading with China until late Victorian England.
And,
ever.
Only Alice could go to China.
Right.
As they say. That was the saying.
So she pitched it to her father-in-law, whose son she just left standing at the altar and after she fell down a hole and hurt her head.
So let's should we go around the room? And so Kelly Wan, you sound a little down on it. You are the resident Tim Burton apologist. I think me and Dinkus are pretty over Tim Burton and have
been. What are you talking about?
No, you're not. Okay, I thought you might want to defend.
I thought you were the Tim Burton apologist. I can't stand Tim Burton's movies.
I did not know that. Oh.
I like Ed Wood, and I like I'm a Sleepy Hollow apologist.
Well, that's a little odd. I don't know. Everybody likes Ed Wood. Nobody in his right mind can deny that Ed Wood is a work of genius, partly because of Tim Burton. There's a lot more going on there.
And look
but
what happens when we
encourage
Sleepy
Hollow. That's odd.
Mm.
That makes you the resident Ed Wood, the resident Tim Burton apologist, I'm afraid.
I can't think of anything else good he's made.
Beetlejuice.
No. So let me get this straight. Alice discovered independence by doing what's drawn on a magic scroll that she's supposed to do and everyone's telling her to do. Was that the point of the movie?
That's sure. Yeah, I'd go with that.
To keep his pants up. Raven in a writing desk.
I don't get that one. I like the one about paper better. Dingus, did it work for you? Because you like me, you're pretty soured on a lot of recent Tim Burton stuff, aren't you?
Yeah, I don't trust him anymore.
Mm-hmm. Did this movie do anything to alleviate that or restore your confidence in him?
No. Okay. It did not.
What confidence was – when was the confidence phase of Tim Burton? Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
Beetlejuice, hello. Why didn't anybody like Beetlejuice?
I would go with Beetlejuice, with Edward Scissorhands, with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, the early Batman stuff. I mean, I think Tim Burton had his definitely has style that had a place.
You're a Tim Burton apologist if you're going that far.
I'm an early Tim Burton apologist.
All the way to Batman. Wait, you're saying?
Well, you
Batman
know what?
Returns?
I will assume the mantle of Tim Burton apologist because I really enjoyed Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, I knew you were setting us up.
Oh.
No, I'm not saying, you know, I mean, it was a forgettable trifle. I'm sure that I will be hard-pressed to remember anything about it in a week. But I really enjoyed it. It wasn't as offensively bad as things like I thought Sleepy Hollow were. Like, I didn't see the usual Tim Burton missteps. There was enough imaginative, crazy stuff in there. And I certainly thought that Mia, I should have figured out how to pronounce her dang name before we start recording. But I certainly thought that the lead actress anchored the movie enough, even though she had no interaction with anything that wasn't CG, it felt like. She's just so watchable. And Tim Burton didn't screw it up too bad. So I think I'll be our resident Alice in Wonderland apologist tonight.
It's Mia Wasikowska, by the way.
Ah, good. Thank you, Dingus. A Polish name. Now, she is Australian. Is that correct? Like, what? She was affecting an English accent, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, but that's all a part of England.
Right. England, I think, is a district of – I mean, Australia is like a district of England, I think. Right.
Australia is right off the shore of Ireland, if I'm not mistaken.
A little south, but yes, that's correct.
Right. It's Ireland, the island of Scotland, and then Australia.
And the capital of Australia, by the way, New Zealand.
New Zealand. They call it New South Wales.
So pronounce her name again, Dingus, because you yourself have a funny name, so you're good at this. Let's hear you say the actress's name. I want to try to learn this.
Well, I'm going to say Wasikowska, because I've taken to pronouncing W's as V's now.
Okay. Now, because you know for a fact, have you heard her say her name or someone pronounce her name, like maybe on NPR?
Yes, I heard somebody on NPR, I think, say Wasikowska.
Okay, good. I'm glad that's
so. I think it's an auditory thesaurus.
It could be Wasikowska or Wasikowska, but I'm going to go with Wasikowska because it sounds really...
It does sound, doesn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, Dingus, you also were a huge fan of her based on In Treatment. How did you feel she fared in Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland?
You know, I have to say I was quite pleased with a lot of the acting in Alice in Wonderland, although I was very not pleased with the direction and what became of the film, but I was quite pleased with Johnny Depp, who I was really not happy with in the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie, and I thought he was really really human for that part, and I thought she was good. I didn't think that she for as talented as I think she is, and if you haven't seen the first season of In Treatment, you really should see it. Because she's a revelation in that, and in this, I don't know what it is about it, but I felt a little underwhelmed because I just didn't feel like she could fly, but I thought most of the acting was really good in this movie.
I, by the way, could not disagree more about Johnny Depp. I just thought he was – I cringed almost every time he was on screen. I didn't get what he was doing. I didn't get why they were making him look like that. I didn't understand why they were focusing on his character and trying to give him some backstory.
He's in it a lot, and you like
– He is.
So you like a lot of him.
I don't understand any – well, let me make clear. I don't understand what they're doing with the characters, and I don't understand what they're doing with the story and the concept of the film at all. But I thought for what he had to do, he brought a great deal of humanity to what he had to do, which was he had to make a connection with Alice, this particular Alice. And I don't agree with what the film is doing at all, but for what the actors had to do, I thought he did an admirable job.
Kelly Wan, we need you to break this tie.
I think Dingus is right, mm-hmm. except for the Johnny Depp part.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking
yeah.
about. Disagreed with me in the thing that we're disagreeing about.
So we're back to a tie.
Yeah. So there's a hot blonde chick in this movie whose clothes keep no longer fitting her. And you go, yeah? And then someone gives her new clothes.
You already did.
You never see anything.
One of the things that I quite liked.
It's very distracting to me.
One of the things that I quite appreciated was the costume progression. She starts in that adorable Alice in Wonderland blue dress. Then they throw on her a series of really unflattering outfits, and she ends up in that awesome Joan of Arc silver armor. So I quite enjoyed the way it starts with a good costume, and then there's a series of terrible costumes that are setting you up for how great she's going to look in that armor with her flowing blonde hair. So there you go. That's how I felt about the.
So you like that ending? And So do you read the source material, since you're not a big fan of reading source material?
I didn't, but I've played video games about Alice in Wonderland. Is that
I think any movie made from source material you haven't read, you will endorse. So basically every adaptation, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, sure.
Hey, there was a video game joke at the Oscars tonight.
Was it about Infinity Ward?
No, it was about Precious, the movie based on Push by the novelist Sapphire. Yeah. I believe Steve Martin said that was the, of the 10 nominees, that was the most successful video game adaptation to a movie.
Racist.
What? Anyway, so Kelly Wand, I'm slightly familiar with Alice in Wonderland. Tom is not.
No, I'm familiar with it. I mean, through cultural osmosis. I'm familiar with it, for instance, as I am with Wizard of Oz, which I've never seen.
No, I'm talking about actually having read it.
But as far as having read it, no, I have not read it, but I am familiar with it. So there's a difference.
But you read Wizard of Oz, obviously.
I'm not a big fan of L. Frank Baum. I just wanted to whip out that name.
Oh, it's a butterfly. Thanks, Tim Burton.
So, Kelly Wan, did you feel that it did or did not do justice to source material? Where were you
going? It was trying. There wasn't much of the – they just recycled the dialogue, like, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when he says what's Raven have in common with the writing desk in the book, he goes, I don't know. Okay, we read that. And then he says it 600 times in the movie and then says he doesn't know at the end. Like the way Steve Carell said missed it by that much and Get Smart. Like they took an interesting line, and they made it sad, like, oh, yeah, missed it by that much. He could have died in the train.
It's sort of like they felt Lewis Carroll needed a punchline.
Yeah, and in a beheading, like she used the Queen's line, off with your head to the monster.
That was weak. The whole conclusion, the battle at the end, and even the Johnny Depp CG dance, I really thought was a weak cap. I mean, it seemed like they were flailing throughout, which I didn't mind until they flailed in terms of trying to bring it all together with the climactic battle and Johnny Depp's CG dancing. I didn't care for any of that.
So basically the ending didn't ruin the movie for you, but it did ruin it for me. Because I was kind of with it for a little while, kind of in a Sherlock Holmes, but like, this is kind of atmospheric. This is kind of better than I thought it was going to be. I like how, like, stupid the boyfriend was at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and just how white and bright everything was. Go on.
I hated how stupid the boyfriend was. That pissed me off. You're just going to make Hamish this stupid little prig, and then...
Well, I thought is maybe she's still dreaming. From the reverse, she's been dreaming for 10 years, and this is her nightmare dream of marrying that guy.
And there's even a great twist, by the way, where isn't it Johnny Depp's character who she said something about she's been having bad dreams, and he assumes she means her real life?
Yeah. See?
But
she doesn't remember. She doesn't remember the other two visits, but they remember her other visits.
Right. So I kind of liked what they were playing around with some of there. But Dingus Gone, why did it bother you that there were such caricatures in the real world?
I had no use for that real world stuff from the first moment. You know, there's this weird thing that goes on in the intro with Martin Sokas and the little girl who's almost like an apparition.
Oh my God, that was not Martin Sokas.
Yeah, and she.
Oh, that
very,
is so awesome! Wow, great.
She's
playing her father.
Yeah, I think so.
But you're not sure? Wait a minute, did you just roll that out and you weren't sure?
Yeah, I'm not, but I think that was him.
Okay.
I didn't look it up. I'm sorry.
That'll be awesome if you're right. But anyway, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
She's this disturbing little girl, and then we go 13 years later, and I just had no patience for this whole. You're going to get married. You have to get married, and that's sort of the thing she has to decide about, and becomes sort of the false bookend for the movie, and we're supposed to think that she's become an empowered woman because she's not marrying this total prig, it's not that she's making a decision that she just doesn't isn't ready or doesn't want to become an ownership or she doesn't want to marry somebody who's a total douche. Well, good for you. Congratulations that this thing is what's led to you, this coming-of-age thing, which, by the way, a coming-of-age film when you're 20. I just
don't
buy it.
Okay,
did you guys ever see or hear the 1985 movie Dream Child? Do you guys remember that movie? Where it's Alice is an old woman, and Ian Holm plays the Reverend Dodgson in it, and there's, like, Muppets in it. It's kind of like this dark, twisted mood piece.
No, I missed it. Sorry.
All right.
Don't know.
All right. Sorry, Tom. Go on.
I was going to say, that makes me – there's a couple of – well, I forgot. So, Dingus, I don't think it's a coming-of-age film. Like, I think – two things. I don't think it is a coming-of-age film. There are a lot of Alice in Wonderland adaptions that are, and certainly Alice in Wonderland – basically, that's what it's leaning towards. And I think one of the kind of cool twists here, I don't want to give too much credit, is that that's not what this is necessarily about, I think. I think it's more with this idea of, like, and I'm probably giving it more thought than the movie did, but it's more with this idea of reconnecting with childhood. But I don't get the sense that that's what you're describing.
It's about growing up, dude. It's the exact opposite of what I think.
So. It's about female empowerment.
It's about the caterpillar becoming a butterfly and her...
Traditionally, right. But it's like Dingus was saying, this is about a 20-year-old woman who hasn't... who has gone through these experiences before, and she's on the threshold of making these adult decisions because she is there. It's not about a little girl. I mean, it's different from your traditional Alice in Wonderland retelling, like, for instance, Tideland or Pan's Labyrinth. I mean, those things are about, like... coming of age in the sense of like a woman coming into sexuality and puberty.
Or Narnia.
This is more, or Narnia, exactly. This seemed more like, you know, someone entering into adulthood. Now, that said, I agree with you, Dingus, that early on, everyone is a caricature. They're painting the decisions that she has to make in very broad, glib strokes. And I don't necessarily hold that against it because I don't think it's trying to be too deep. It's just sort of presenting a basic character sketch. And then it's going to go off on a wacky fantasy direction and then finally come back to the basic, easy, glib decisions that she has to make.
Right.
And furthermore, she's going to discover China. I mean, I kind of...
Yeah,
right.
So Wonderland's the China of the fantasy universe.
but I disagree with that altogether as a direction to go, and that's why I have no use for that stuff and why I think it's based on its casting decision, trying to be a coming-of-age film but failing. And you're right, it ultimately is not that, but I think it's trying to have its cake and eat it too.
And what do you mean based on a casting decision?
Because they want to cast Mia Wasikowska in the film because she's awesome, but she's too old to be a girl who's like the Pan's Labyrinth or the Tideland that you're talking about. But she's too young to be sort of an older girl, and they don't want to. And to their credit, they're not trying to make us believe she's like the an education level girl. She's almost in her 20s, and they're letting us believe that. But they're having her go through these ridiculous things. And the reason why this doesn't work for me is that she's apparently had this nightmare for 13 years or longer, and she's. She's in the nightmare again, and I just think Alice as a character is too smart not to be able to know the moment she lands this is different than all the other nights before, and instead she stumbles around for so long going, oh, this is just a dream, it can't hurt me, this is just a dream, it can't hurt me, but I don't believe any of it, and supposedly she's had this over and over and over again for 13 years or so,
right.
and still we're supposed to have all these surprises. I don't think any of the framework they've built works.
Okay, but I mean they are covering passes in that she does forget every time, and Johnny Depp at the end knows she's going to forget him again. There's this sense that she's repeating this over and over, and it's like an eternal recurrence. It's almost existential, it seemed. So you say she's smart, and yes, she is, and she figures out the puzzles, but
and afterwards she remembers Tweedledum and Tweedledee, so they break that rule too.
Ah, right. But will she then later forget? I mean, I don't know. Has she completely grown out of visiting, you know, Wonderland, as she used to call it? I don't know.
So,
I mean, Dingus,
so
you're right. Framework is weak. I totally agree with you there. But I think you're wrong to assume it's a coming of age thing. So I don't think that's what they're going for. And I'm not sure why you expect more sort of. I'm not sure why you expect less caricature from just a basic character introduction, like where she's going to marry a dork. I think it would be a completely different kind of movie if it were a really difficult decision who she was going to marry.
Like Avatar.
No, it's not who she's going to marry. It's the decision to get married. The point is that she doesn't want to become somebody's property, that she doesn't want to make that decision that is expected of her.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of making it a difficult decision, are you going to go into this – thing that everybody else has done, which is a reasonable thing that girls do at this age,
right?
Or are you going to become your own woman and branch out and become an entrepreneur? Instead of making it that kind of decision, they make it, are you going to marry this troll or are you going to become your own woman? And I think that is that is ridiculous, and that is just one of many missteps this film makes.
So she marries his father because he's richer.
So basically, Dean, is your issue more with the character of, was his name Hamish?
Hamish, yeah. Well, I just think that is indicative of the missteps that this film makes. That instead of going for some intricate, difficult conceptual choices, it takes the easy stereotypical choices, and it disappoints me. I think Alice can be a smart character who talks to herself and who debates with herself and who has a really strong, amazing internal struggle, and instead we make it a girl who's trying to dither around in a nightmare and is making a decision about whether or not to marry a douche.
Mm-hmm.
And she only dithers in the movie once she gets to Wonderland, like after all these big empowerment speeches, but then they go, oh yeah, here on the scroll it says you're going to totally kick the Jabberwocky's ass, and then she breaks down. Like after all those other times where she wasn't scared at all and faced down the Bandersnatch.
Mm-hmm.
Defend that, Tom.
I'm a little surprised that you guys had those expectations from it. I really didn't, coming into a Tim Burton movie, I was fine with just some flights
of
fancy.
It's an Alice in Wonderland movie. And to me...
But you know what? That's the thing. It's not really. Like, to me, Alice in Wonderland... is the subtext of Alice in Wonderland is, and maybe Kelly, want to back me up on this, is the subtext of Alice in Wonderland somehow, is there some sexuality to it?
Because
there certainly is to like Pan's Labyrinth and Tideland and other Alice in Wonderland alike.
Yeah, but it's about other stuff more. Like it could just as easily be a boy.
So all of that, like I think there was no subtext to this. This movie was puddle shallow.
There's a lot of math humor, and that's what I was missing from this movie. There's a
lot of the Lewis Carroll stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. What I want to get at is this movie was puddle shallow, and that was okay with me. I didn't really expect it to – I didn't really mind that it didn't go the more thoughtful route of other Alice in Wonderland-type stories.
Well, the visuals – I liked a lot of the character designs, and I was kind of – oh, hi, Kat. Thank you for that. And I was enjoying the acting, too. So when the script didn't go places, the script's surrealness wasn't keeping up with any of the imagery on screen.
Well, and that, by the way, is where I'm a little bit – where Dingus, I sort of agree with your assessment overall, but that's why it didn't really bother me in the real-world stuff. Where it bothered me more was in the Wonderland stuff. Like with I thought how underdeveloped and I didn't get what was going on with Johnny Depp's character or why she was so upset when she found out that she was going to have to face the Jabberwocky alone. Those were the moments that bothered me far more than the fact that her fiancé was a douche. Like that, I wouldn't have expected anything else from the movie.
I think you're voicing my overarching frustration with this film, and where my expectations were unreasonable. And that going to this, I expected this to be a less coherent film. I expected to be a fever dream or a drug-induced kind of a dream. And what I got was, go get the sword and kill the dragon. It became very linear, what you say, puddle shallow. And that was constantly frustrating to me. There wasn't a world of wonder here. And I expected there to be less coherence. And what Tim Burton made was an Alice in Wonderland that was completely coherent. And I did not want that. And I shouldn't have expected that. You're right, Tom. But that was my basic frustration with it and why I am sort of branching out to make fun of Hamish. Because Hamish isn't my main problem. My main problem is that it's a coherent, let's go get the sword and kill the dragon movie when it should have been a fever dream.
You didn't feel that any of the stuff, like with Helena Bonham Carter wanting to warm her aching feet with a warm pig belly, like I thought there were some great moments of incoherence. Overall, I agree with you. It didn't have that fever dream quality, but it had enough instances of like, what's going on? Mainly around her, by the way, who I really enjoyed. That's another performance that I quite enjoyed in the movie. But little moments like that weren't enough for you?
Oh, I agree with you. I loved her. But I thought little moments like that were weird for weirdness sake. And there's a difference between making something into sort of a fantasy and a dream and using a pig for a foot cushion, or using let's cross a moat on floating heads, which
I thought that was great. I loved that. You didn't like that?
No, from what I remember from the story, she doesn't get to cut off anybody's heads, and that's one of the great absurdities about this. And instead, she's walking on people's heads, and that's fine. And I might have been distracted by the fact that it was hard for me to picture the 3-year-old sitting in front of me watching her walk across severed heads, and that's not fair to the filmmaker. But I thought that things like the pig were fine and were cute and were funny, but I didn't think they were by any means worthy. I thought they were just weird for weirdness' sake. And
I thought those were the fake heads that they all wore to not piss her off.
No, it was clearly there. People had been beheaded, I'm pretty sure, because the king's head
was
shown in the moat. And I loved that touch. I loved when she walked up to the moat and there were like rocks and she's going to go across. And then I realized, oh, their faces, that's kind of weird. And then I realized, oh, she's actually been beheading people. I liked that little twist. I loved, for instance, the frog stealing the tart. The animation in that, and the interaction between Helen and Bob.
And there was some darkness in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we should have expected.
I mean, overall, Dingus, I think Dingus, I agree with your complaint, Dingus, on a macro level. There were micro instances of weirdness, and on a macro level, I hated the stupid video game progression of it. I'm with you 100% there. But there were enough distractions along the way that, you know, I thought it was pretty inspired. And Kelly Wan, tell me if this was from the source material. The Dormouse taking the Bandersnatch's eye and then Alice giving it back. Kelly Wan, is that in the source? That's in the source material?
I think it's in Through the Looking Glass.
Okay. So I like
them as the Red Queen and the Queen of Hearts. They're both different people and they're in different books and they're not related. And everyone always mixes them.
So just those, some of those touches I quite enjoyed and they sustained me. Even though there wasn't enough of that on a macro level. So I agree with you there, Dingus.
I think when we got to the moat, for instance, because we'd been running along with that dog, who the dog made me think of the dogs and Up and how much more I preferred them. And then there's a moment where the White Queen is talking to the dog, I think. Or there's a moment with the dog where somebody's talking to
the dog. I got confused by the dog subplot. Like, is he a double agent or a triple agent?
Well, all of a sudden, I started to feel like, you know, this is no better than Shrek.
Oh, Dingus, that's a low blow.
I realize it is, but from animation to what the film was trying to do, although it's not as terrible with the awful pop references, I don't mean that. But I just felt like, you know, the animation in this, and we haven't even gotten to the 3D aspect of it yet.
Yes.
I just got to the point of, like, this doesn't have much on Shrek.
That's a terrible, terrible thing to say. You're a nasty person.
I agree. I totally agree with you.
But see, you say it doesn't have anything on Shrek, but this uses human performances. Shrek does not have that. Shrek is all in celebrity voice acting and cutesy drawings. This has Helena Bonham Carter with a big old fat head on a little pot. It's awesome. This has a really creepy-looking Anne Hathaway being like a good guy and putting urine and severed fingers in a potion, which was great.
But you can't kill any of those things.
This, you know, and this even Crispin Glover, I can just, even when the guy is, they don't take advantage of his weirdness like this, I can just watch that guy forever because I know how weird he is, and I'm watching to see, is he going to do something weird? Here he didn't, and that was okay. I just still find him so watchable. And certainly, I don't know, to boil it down to Shrek, that must be, Dingus, when you say that, I understand how you must feel when I try to tell you that Avatar was ugly.
Yeah, and I understand that it's pretty unfair for me to say that, because this film has a lot more going for it than Shrek. But there was just a moment when the dog is talking to somebody where some sort of joke is made, and that thought just occurred to me, and I realize it's unfair. Because something that you just said, and I loved Anne Hathaway in this. I loved what she was doing. I loved the sense of humor she brought to it. Mm-hmm. I thought she was very interesting. And like I said before, I thought most of the performances were really great. I just thought that a lot of the visuals, including the 3D, were really awkward. And I thought that the story was far too shallow for what I think Alice can be a far more interesting and introspective character. And they reduced her. And if you're going to hire somebody like Mia Wasikowska to do it, she has so many tools in her arsenal. Let her use them.
Yeah, I think you're expecting a different movie, and that's
you're thinking
that's
of
fine.
Dr. Parnassus and Terry Gilliam, and not
you're absolutely right, Kelly Wands. You're absolutely right. And when we flew into the castle for the first time, that's exactly what I thought.
Yeah, me too.
That moment when we fly down into the monk's fortress in Dr. Parnassus, and how awesome that looked,
yeah.
And how flat for all the 3D this castle looked. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. None of these set pieces suggest much depth, too. Like, you were always boxed in by fog and smoke and bricks, so it seemed like a strange choice for... Because in Avatar, there was a sense of depth, or a sense of acreage, more. And in this,
yeah,
you just go, oh, yeah, now they're going back to this set. The siege screen.
I did not think that I would hear the term acreage used so well tonight.
And I, without reference to Mia Wasikowska's acreage,
I just can't really think of her that way, Kelly Wand.
She's coming out of her clothes for the whole movie. It's
having seen In Treatment, I just can't think of her that way. There's so much. I know she's an actress, but the character she played in Treatment just had so much depth and transcended simply being cute or adorable or anything.
I was hot for Alice when I was seven, so now it's like.
She's a daughter or a sister.
Exactly. I think of Mia Wasikowska as a daughter after getting to know this character she created in In Treatment so well.
And I want to be a Mormon.
Stop it.
Oh, wow. I apologize to all of our Mormon listeners, both of them.
Yeah. That's like half our listening base.
So you guys – oh, go ahead, Dingus.
Well, what I was going to ask, Tom, is that Kelly and I have given sort of – we've just given reference to how we feel about the 3D. You saw it in 3D. How did you feel about that?
I was okay with it. I mean, I think I've said this before, but it's almost like subtitles. After a while, I forget I'm seeing it in 3D until one of those card soldier spears is like poking in my face, or the March Hare throws something at the screen. But
yeah.
I can take it or leave it.
I know, and they keep stuffing it down her throat.
Well, there were a few shots where I was like, okay, I know, you got to do your money shot,
yeah.
You're paying for 3D, fine, whatever. But it didn't bother me, I didn't mind it, and I wouldn't have minded not seeing it in 3D, which I didn't feel that way. I think my first experience with this latest Gen 3D was seeing Up, and I really liked it in Up, and
yeah.
I think if I were paying attention a different way, I'd be curious to contrast Up's 3D with Alice in Wonderland, where there are things poking out of the screen, and it feels like they're trying to earn it really hard. And I never felt that about Up. So how do you guys feel? Did it work for you?
In Up, it always seemed like they went more 3D for like the big panoramic shots.
Acreage.
Oh, no. Yeah,
Acreage. Yeah.
And in Wonderland, it was just kind of random.
Yeah. Yeah, Johnny Depp throwing out the scrolls, which I remember from the trailer. They did nothing. I mean, that was just
no.
Like, it was just stupid. Yeah, we're going to have things come at you from the screen.
So the Jabberwocky has to chase her on foot, even though it can fly.
Well, so Dingus, did the 3D work for you? Because I want to talk about that Jabberwocky thing before we move on. How did you feel about the 3D, Dingus?
No, I thought it was totally tacked on. I mean, some of what you guys said. I haven't seen Up, and I didn't see Coraline either, which I think was in 3D too, wasn't it?
Yes, Coraline. Released, yeah.
But this felt far more like even Crispin Glover like threw his hand at the screen at one point. And I'm like, will you guys stop throwing things at me? But it was so poorly done that it felt like somebody had cut out characters and then pasted them on glass in front of the background. The characters to me flattened out. There was no sense of acreage, to use Kelly Wan's excellent term. To be the resident Avatar apologist, the 3D really made a difference for me in that film. I really felt like it made a world for me. And this, it just felt like, well, let's just get on the 3D bandwagon. We have to do this. This is what the studio says we have to do. It's going to bring people into the theater.
Yeah.
And even the glasses I used were real painful. They were like cheap Ray-Bans that you might buy on the street. It just didn't work for me, and I would prefer to see not – I don't want glasses in front of my glasses. I have to wear glasses
to
put in.
And the IMAX screen is supposed to, like, engulf you. So if you're wearing these 3D glasses that aren't – it's like you have these frames around the edges of your peripheral vision that's smaller than the IMAX screen. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. And
boxed in. That's a stupid feeling.
I don't need an extra layer. And especially if it's not going to add anything. And I didn't feel until the final credit.
If your head's not completely straight, it doesn't work. Because if your head tilts a little because you're getting tired, then you lose that. Everything's blurry.
You know, until they can find a way to do 3D where I don't have to wear glasses, just forget it. I don't want to bother with it.
Harsh room.
They have 3D. It's called Plays.
But the problem is...
Very nice.
Nice, Kelly Wand.
The problem is I'm going to go to movies as much as I can, and they're trying to get people who aren't going to. So,
yeah.
You know, we have to put up with that.
Yeah.
Go ahead with the Jabberwocky.
Yeah, let's talk about the Jabberwocky and specifically the final battle. So Kelly Wand, as our source material resident expert, is Jabberwocky it's a separate poem. Does it have anything to do with Alice?
It's referenced in Through the Looking Glass.
Oh, it is. Okay. I didn't realize it was part of that. Okay, so, Kelly Wand, did you have a problem with the Jabberwocky? Because I had one I want to talk about, but you go ahead.
I didn't like how it fought, and mm-hmm. I didn't like how it didn't fly. Mm-hmm. And I kind of liked that it breathed lasers.
I think that was electrical breath.
But a Bandersnatch, can extend its neck, and they didn't do that. I was very upset.
So I thought, and this is a macro level complaint, and Dingus, I'm sure you'll be on board with me on this one. They're setting up the idea that it's the Vorpal Sword, which of course everybody knows a Vorpal Sword goes snicker snack and it beheads the Jabberwocky. You know, it's not a stupid video game battle where it's banging her around with its tail and she runs up to the top of the spire and she clings onto its back and it throws her in the air and then luckily she's poised to like fall down and cut through. I mean, I would have totally, totally been fine with her just flipping the sword and winning. I mean, I didn't need a stupid... And then when they come out on the chessboard, I'm like, oh, are you guys going to do a big stupid battle scene? Are you going to be able to resist that? Do we really need that? And unfortunately, we do. I mean, it was such conventional, let's have a big Star Wars kind of ending with different action pieces that will intercut with each other, supposedly for tension. And I just didn't want a big, conventional, stupid battle with a Jabberwocky.
Yeah, and those armies clash.
She's doing, like, wire foo. I mean, she wasn't doing that, but I didn't need to see her actually have to fight. The whole idea was whoever shows up with the sword is going to win. I mean, that should be the trump card and not something that if you get lucky enough to get into position. Like, I loved her outfitted in the armor. That was a great payoff, but I didn't really need a big, stupid fight scene.
Well, it's supposed to be a nonsense world. Like, you think Alice is the one who can crack the codes.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a Matrix thing. Make the bullocks stop, you know? Just break the rules. Exactly.
Yeah. Instead, she suddenly knows how to use a Vorpal Sword.
The thing is, you're with me on that, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Well, as much as they tried to make the final battle more exciting in pyrotechnic, it was so boring.
It really was.
Yeah.
And somebody even says in the movie that the sword is the thing that's going to win the battle.
Yeah, well, even the dragon. So,
I'm sorry, but worlding it.
Doesn't is that did Christopher Lee show up for two lines as the Jabberwocky? Am I mistaken?
I don't even know. I was close to falling
asleep. So the Jabberwocky says, "So we meet again, old foe."
He's talking to the sword.
And Alice says, "I've never met you before." And he's like, "I'm not talking about you, insignificant wielder. I'm talking about the Vorpal Blade."
That's right.
And I was almost certain that was Christopher Lee. And I'm like, oh, the Jabberwocky's going to talk. Awesome. There'll be some conversation and some witty dialogue. And then he doesn't say anything else. I'm so disappointed.
You've got to be right about that.
Good Lord. I was just, I mean, you know.
It is a man killing the Jabberwocky in the poem, by the way. I'm just saying.
Oh, so it's not an Alice.
He took his Vorpal sword in hand. Long time the maxim foe he sought, so rested he by the tum-tum tree and stood a while and thought.
So what does it have to do with Alice?
Someone's just saying the poem to her.
Ah, see, okay. That's good Lord.
So they turn that into that. See, this is why source material matters more to me than to you, because I know that going in, and I go, oh, yeah, it's going on.
Well, you know, I'm always okay with source material being ignored if it's to good effect, and I'm not sure I necessarily feel that's the case here. Like, I didn't need a goofy dragon battle.
No.
And by the way, that was Christopher Lee. I just want to say they got Christopher Lee to show up and do two lines in Alice in Wonderland.
Did you look that up?
Maybe.
Are we still recording?
I looked it up on a separate computer, so it's not going to cut us off. But yes, according to IMDb, Christopher Lee is the Jabberwocky. Now, seriously, you guys did not hear that voice and instantly realize Christopher Lee?
I did. I don't know what Dingus is
talking about. Dingus, you need to watch those Lord of the Rings movies sometimes, right?
I winced. I was like, oh, yeah, Christopher Lee.
Wait, that's if you're one gonna... about that child who's a sorcerer and he has, like, a little wand. Is that right?
No, that's Lightning Thief. That's Percy Jackson you're thinking of.
It's Thick at the Base.
Dingus, you were going to ask a question. What?
This is a worthless question after that comment. here's my question for you two fellows. What do you think of the idea of Alice's point of view? Like, I was just thinking of this as I watched the movie, and there's a couple of scenes that take place where she's not in the room.
I know, yeah.
What do you think about that?
If you're going to make that decision, that's fine. And when they did make that decision, I was a little bit – I questioned the wisdom of it. But because it gave us more Helena Bonham Carter, I was okay with it.
Not bad. Okay.
She's the one drinking.
Do you think it would have –
Why does she have the sword? Why does the queen have the sword? How'd she get it? How'd she get the Jabberwocky? Does that matter at all? How come she's commanding it?
She got
what
it
was
from
the question?
Tell me when
Voldemort. I'm asking the fish tank memorial question is that, do you think we should have any scenes that Alice isn't involved in that aren't from her point of view or aren't part of her sort of...
No, it's a stupid movie because of that. Okay. Boo. Thumbs down.
Is that kind of what you're getting at, Dingus? You think it hurt it by not sticking with Alice?
I think that's a no-brainer, although your argument that we get more Helena Bonham Carter is a compelling argument because while seeing her on the posters, I found completely annoying. I loved her.
Yeah.
And I really liked Crispin Glover, too, even though I found a lot of the visuals surrounding him to be very awkward. And I guess they were awkward on purpose. But when he gets on his horse, it's this weird, choppy awkwardness. It feels like a weird cutscene from a video game.
But with Crispin Glover's face pasted over it, yeah.
Exactly. But if we get more Helena Bonham Carter, I guess that's okay. But I just don't see how you can justify not having her in every moment of the movie, if it's her dream or if we're supposed to believe it's her dream. Or even if not, I just think that her being around is important.
Well, you know, Dingus, isn't that thinking... And I agree it would be stronger material, but isn't that thinking colored by Pan's Labyrinth and Tideland, where everything you see, everything that happens, is from the perspective of the little girl?
Fish tank.
But I agree, like, if you do a stronger retelling of Alice in Wonderland, like those two movies I just mentioned, stick with the little girl. But if you're going to do just some glib special effects feature with wacky characters, it's okay to range farther and wider, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess that's true, and I guess you can justify it from that point of view. But if you're going to do that, I just expect a little bit more spectacle.
It was
you're
thoughtless.
Going to go for that. Because I loved it. What did you say, Kelly?
It gave the air of being thoughtless, and like they didn't even make that connect. Like, oh wait, Alice isn't in this scene. Like they didn't even go, she could maybe be imagining it or something. Like they didn't care.
Well, to be fair, I don't think it was ever trying to do a fake out there. Where is it real? Is it not real?
No.
I don't think that was ever part of the equation. So that's another reason too, Dingus, that I think movies like, well, not Tideland, but certainly Pan's Labyrinth. That's a huge concern in Pan's Labyrinth. Is this real or is it not real? I don't think that Alice in Wonderland, the Tim Burton one we just saw, that ever considers that it's not real.
Okay. Well, that's why it's disappointing to me that she doesn't get it. Because if there's no question that it's whether it's real or not real, so what, you know, that it is real for us, then I think Alice is smart enough to know that and smart enough to suss that out. And I think it's a more interesting film if she knows that from the beginning and she embraces what's going on here and she gets it. I mean, there's a moment where I think when she's at tea with the Mad Hatter and the world looks rather desolate, and it's a difference from the first time she's been there, but she has no way of knowing that, and he sort of tries to explain it. It reminds me of this series of books I read called The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever, where Thomas Covenant comes to the land the second time and it's totally changed and not what he's expecting it to be.
Sunbane, bruh.
And she could have sort of had this sort of feeling of like, I'm returning to, even if I'm returning to my nightmare, the world is different now. But she has no concept of any touchstone for this. And if we're not going to make it a mystery of is it real or is it not, then why not have her in on it? Because she's a smart girl.
I think Dingus, the reason is because what the movie is going for, and whether it's successful or not is another discussion, but what they're going for is more of an idea of a hero living up to his or her fate or obligation, almost like a Lord of the Rings thing. You know,
because will it was Frodo deliver like a marriage license.
Will Frodo deliver the ring? You know, will Luke Skywalker inherit the, you know, it's this idea of the hero has a course to go on, and his struggle is embracing that destiny kind of thing. Yeah. And instead of playing with this idea of an imaginary world or a child's flight of fancy. And I would maybe agree that it's certainly a weaker choice when you're dealing with Alice in Wonderland. But I think that's what they were going for rather than some of the stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that.
Kelly, one, what? Go ahead, Dingus.
No, but that's sort of my basic disappointment with it. You know, because you have a girl at the beginning who's saying, what does she say? To me, a corset is like a codfish. And she seems like somebody who thinks completely outside the box, and she gets down in this world and she doesn't, and then she has to be taught how to do so, as if in the real world she doesn't think that way. And I think rather than making her start over from point zero, let her start over from where she is in the real world and go up from that.
Mm-hmm. She already knows all this before she even goes there. She doesn't learn anything. She already doesn't want to marry that guy. So there's no growth.
There's no need for her to learn that lesson.
She's learned it every night for 13 years. What is she, a chimp?
What were you going to ask, Kelly?
I forget.
No, I was asking Tom. He was going to ask you something or say something to you.
Oh.
I was going to ask Kelly Wand who was his favorite flower of those three flower characters in the beginning.
Chrysanthemum?
Good answer. I'll go with that.
What are the other ones?
There's chrysanthemum, daisy.
Gladiola.
And gladiola, yes. Mm. Of course.
So Oz has apple trees, right?
I have never seen Wizard of Oz. I can't help you with that.
Oh.
Did you guys get... So I imagine the horsefly and the dragonfly, that's got to be straight out of the source material. That's way too smart for the movie to think of, yeah?
I don't know.
Okay.
I like the Cheshire Cat. Does that count?
Who was that voice?
Alan Rickman?
No, that was the Caterpillar. Kelly Wand, oh, you suck at celebrity voice.
Yeah.
Dingus, who was the Cheshire Cat? Steve Carell?
Stephen Fry.
Oh, Stephen. Oh, okay, that's good. I like that.
So I meant.
I like the design of the Cheshire Cat. I mean, that's kind of what he looks like. They didn't do anything imaginative. So you guys were really okay with the Johnny Depp color scheme and the contact lenses.
When did I say that? I thought
and
the, so.
Oh, okay. And why did he randomly become Scottish? What is that just because he was mad? You guys were okay. Or, Dingus, you were okay with all that.
Well, I thought that like the, you know, you guys made some mention earlier of it felt like a lot of the lines were thrown in as just in the way that the lines were thrown in The Road, sort of like, let's get their greatest hits in here. Like at one point at the beginning, she goes, curiouser and curiouser, and then just runs off as if I had to get this line in here. And so when he does the Jabberwocky poem, it sort of had that feel to it. And I kind of felt like Johnny Depp sort of said, how do I make this unlike what else is going on? Like I have to use a different voice to sort of introduce this sort of other level of madness or
how
reality.
How can I make it even more incomprehensible?
Right. And so it felt a little weird, but I got distracted by wondering, is Jabberwocky a part of this? I thought this was a separate poem. So I didn't necessarily like that, nor did I like his last dance. I thought that was idiotic.
Gosh.
And it felt tacked on. Either you make it 2 minutes long and everybody joins in, or just cut it. It just felt like a ridiculous moment. So, you know,
the music was very Lucas-y, too. It was very Return of the Jedi remix Ewoks, wasn't it?
Oh, good point. Yeah, it really was. Yeah.
What was the dance called? Futter watching?
Flubberta Juggalins.
Kelly Wand, is that from the source material?
Yeah, and so is that music.
All right, okay.
It's worth seeing if you leave 10 minutes early. Who's with me?
I didn't miss the fact, Kelly Wan, that she opens trade with China. That's huge. I loved how out of left field that was. I love the fact that she's going to become a partner in Victorian England, finally opening trade with China.
You know, by that point, I was just grateful that the guy...
Well, she showed it to him on a map. He hadn't seen a map before. She did.
I was just grateful that the guy didn't turn out to have murdered her father, because I thought that's where we were going.
What?
The original investor who was like, I got this idea from your father. And then I thought we were going to turn around to get to that point where, like, this is the evil investor who murdered my father, and I have outed you.
Yeah, and she looks like her father, or he. That's the pronoun I meant.
You're like the Mad Hatter. And by the way, Dingus, you're absolutely right. Martin Sokas, very good. I didn't recognize him, I guess, under the mutton chops or whatever they were doing to make him look Victorian. Well done.
Hey, did people in your audience, when the Red Queen licked the strawberry tart from the frog's mouth, they all go, ew.
My audience was not very participatory.
Oh.
Did you get that, Kelly Wan? They ewed?
Yeah, but it was right after I streaked.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between. Counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, that's free, getting down with free the peak, everybody loves ocean.
So, Kelly Wan, now that you have put your clothes back on, why don't you give us this week's 3x3?
What do you think that?
What are we?
It felt like we got rescued.
What do you got for us, Kelly Wan?
I just had to say dumb thing after dumb thing, and Tom wouldn't play the music. It took forever. I'm just trying for 20 minutes to earn it. Do I play the street card? Is that what we're reduced to?
Earn this.
Yeah, strawberry tarts. This is the worst, by far, I think, 3x3 topic ever, and I humbly apologize for... Especially following Tom's awesome 3x3 last week with the recasting.
Now, before you get so down on it, tell us what it is and what you were thinking.
Well, I was thinking I'll use this one now, and then I'll try and come up with something better in 3 weeks when my turn comes around again.
This is a stopgap.
Yeah, this was I figure no one's listening.
All right.
So it's top 3 movies for which there can be no forgiveness. So it's basically opposite of Dingus's desert island list.
Mm-hmm.
3 movies you wouldn't take with you to a desert island because you can't forgive them. Forgive. You have to forgive. See, Tom forgives Alice in Wonderland. It's a crappy ending. So it would make this list.
Well, you don't know that yet. You haven't heard what I came up with and how I gamed the list. You'll see.
Did you gimp it or did you lame it?
We'll see. So Dingus has to go first because Dingus is introducing next week's. So Dingus, what is your number? So it's 3 movies for which there can be no forgiveness. And to your credit, Kelly Wand, the one thing about this week's 3x3, it's grammatically correct.
Because the preposition's after the proposition.
You were very particular. Good job.
Well, that's where my
How would you say that incorrectly?
Ended.
How would you say that incorrectly?
Three movies there can be no forgiveness for.
I thought you were going to say 3 movies that I have no forgiveness with.
I guess Unforgiven would be my number one.
Wait, whoa, you can't jump ahead.
Oh.
Okay, I got to change my list.
For next week, we're going to do...
All right, Dingus, kick us off.
Let's end this.
Number 3.
I apologize. Let's get this over with. This is terrible.
Kelly, you have nothing to apologize for. I got really actually excited as I worked on this and pretty passionate about it. So do not apologize. Cut it out.
All right. Well, let's hear the list and then we'll see if you're forgiven.
Oh, wow. Way to stick the knife in.
Yeah. It'll be your fault now. See?
Okay. Guilty.
Because you defended my bad list.
All right, the number 3 of my choices of films for which there can be no 2 forgiveness from, this is my easy gimme choice, and this would be the movie Crash. And I don't even know if I need to say anything else, so we can just move on. This is my easy pick, and I still find it unforgivable. First of all, it won Best Picture, and I used that tonight. in sort of a commemorative way.
It was the Avatar of 2005.
Except that it won. That year there were, and I'm not necessarily going to name films that were nominated, but of the films I loved that year, there's Squid and the Whale, there's Brokeback Mountain, Capote, Grizzly Man, The New World. Grizzly Man, of course, wouldn't have been up for that, but these are all better films than Crash.
Well, if they'd done the tent movies, then it wouldn't have been on it.
Crash wouldn't have been in my top 25. And you know, forget it. I don't even have to use a number. It wouldn't have been in my top any number that you can think of. I find this film unforgivable because as I watched, I realized that what they were doing was taking the template of a film I adore called Magnolia and just making it completely shallow and facile, to use two terms that Tom likes.
Glib, and also. He's glib.
Glib, making it like this television playhouse drama, right down to weird stuff falling from the sky at the end in Los Angeles. It is a fraud. The film is a total fraud. And more than this, what makes it unforgivable to me is that it made me have to insult a couple of good friends of mine, which is totally embarrassing and humiliating to me because I hated it so much that I said awful, evil things about it and the people who liked it. And I really shouldn't have done that.
Were these friends black?
No, these friends were not black.
All Dingus said, and here's an example of how Dingus is such a nice guy. All Dingus said was something like, "Crash is Magnolia for retards," or some. It was some off the cuff for idiots. Right. That's right. It was just some off the cuff comment in front of a few people who loved Crash. And that's the weird thing with Crash, isn't it, Dingus?
How can you love Crash?
It really moved some people. My little sister loves Crash, I believe. And I don't understand that, but that's fine. But it really moved some people, and for some people it really worked very well. And it's a weird thing to me and Dingus, I think. Kelly Wynn, you didn't like it, right?
No, I was appalled, and I couldn't believe it won.
By the way, little known fact, when we were casting about for names for this podcast, one of the ones that we almost went with was Crash Sucks.
Not many people remember that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I will never forgive Paul Haggis for making a film so awful that I insulted people that I really care about, including little sisters of ours. And I feel bad about that, so you cannot be forgiven. Guilty.
Well, so I hate or like Magnolia, these people you mocked?
I think it's possible to really dig the whole Magnolia style and just sort of like that style or that approach to storytelling and therefore dig Crash, like not mind some of the problems that we had with it.
Right.
So my approach to this list, I didn't want to just do a list movies I hated because that's I wanted to do something more interesting with this. I wanted to find a twist here. And Kelly Wand, what good Lord, movies for which they're going to be forgiven. I mean, I don't like Crash, and I'm like, fine, whatever, and I move it. And I don't even think about it. I don't give Crash much thought. So here's what I came up with for my three movies. These were three movies that genuinely offended some sensibility that I have. And they're not necessarily bad. Oh, you know what? They are all bad movies, but the fact that they're bad is incidental to my being offended. There was something specific in these movies that I found offensive. Now, I watch a lot of horror films. I watch a lot of bad action movies. So being bad isn't enough to just offend me. So the first movie that I have that genuinely offended me was Beautiful Mind, the Ron Howard thing with Russell Crowe, which is about a math professor who's I don't know what his particular malady is, but he's got some sort of psychological. Is he schizophrenic? Do you guys know? Like, what's his specific malady in the movie? Multiple personality. Anyway, whatever it is,
he has a beautiful mind.
He does have a beautiful mind, but the movie presents this idea that even though he's got some serious mental disability that puts other people around him in danger. By the time the movie is over, it's trying to give you this feel-good message that he's going to buck medication and just wrestle this problem into control. And I feel that that is such a misrepresentation of the seriousness of the kind of mental illnesses that for which people have to take medication. And I just found that so offensive that we're going to do a feel-good movie about a guy who just decides he's going to get over being mentally ill. Beautiful Mind offended me for that reason. And I'm also reminded, as I was thinking about Beautiful Mind, I was thinking there's another movie that I thought took a really glib approach to mental illness, and it involves Laura Linney having a younger brother who's mentally disabled and who gets violent towards her. And I couldn't for the life of me think what it was, and it finally occurred to me. Dingus, does that ring any bells for you? Because you like the movie. What? What?
Is Philip Seymour Hoffman in it?
Nope, it's not The Savages. You like this
movie?
Me. Yes. No? Love Actually. In the Laura Linney subplot, there's a thing where her younger brother keeps calling her and interrupting her when she's going to have Love Actually with whoever she's in love with. And I just remember how glib it was towards him being mentally disabled and violent towards her. So anyway, that offended me in Beautiful Mind, and for that reason, that movie, there can be no... I have no forgiveness for it.
But they don't suggest that he beat the mental illness, just he's going to fail miserably at it.
At the end, he's like back to teaching again, and he even says, like, he catches up with an old friend and explains to the old friend he's not taking his medication anymore. And if he has to check, there's like a joke where he has to check to see if anybody is imaginary like Paul Bettany is.
Well, by the way, Tom, these movies offend me too, so your little title for it applies to mine too. Don't think you're great.
Yeah, Crash offended me.
Yeah, see.
Well, Crash, I just thought was bad. The point I tried to make is I'm not easily offended. Crash had a bunch of really superficial stuff about race relations
which is offensive.
I don't find it offensive. If you want to have a movie, you know, if you can have some feel good, you know what else has a superficial message about race relations which didn't offend me is The Blind Side. You know what? If you don't want your movie to really tackle that, and even if you want to pretend it is, I don't need that in a movie necessarily.
So it's every Sandra Bullock movie, because Speed also had that black dude who pulled the gun on.
I see what you did there, using the word tackle after mentioning Blindside, by the way.
Get it?
But there was, seriously though, to me there was nothing offensive in Crash beyond it being just a tacky, ten-eared, tone-deaf movie. It didn't offend me like it did where Beautiful Mind suggests that if you're mentally disabled and if you're on medication, you know what? It's like Tom Cruise or somebody coming out or Jenny McCarthy coming out and saying, don't vaccinate your children. I mean, it's preaching something that I feel is actually harmful. And I don't think Crash did that.
I think it is offensive. And by the way, Jenny McCarthy has turned the corner on that.
Yeah.
What?
Rehab.
No, she found out that her son doesn't have autism after all, and she feels bad about that.
Wow, okay, good for her.
They meant artistic.
So that's my number three. And again, I just want to say, I'm not easily offended. You know what? Irreversible did not offend me. It was tough to watch, but I didn't find it offensive. That's Martyrs, I've told you guys about this horrible, horrible, difficult to watch horror film called Martyrs, and it didn't offend me necessarily. Kelly Wand, what's your number three?
See, now I feel like I should redo my list, because
you always feel that way, and you're not allowed to.
Because Fitzcarraldo, he killed real Indians, but you get this really cool movie out of it. So maybe there's forgiveness there for taking human life, because you get the movie about the opera house.
Werner Herzog killed. You mean they died in the filming?
Yeah.
I don't think Werner Herzog actually killed any Indians.
That's killing him. That makes
they died under his watch. So damn it.
Didn't he pull a gun on him?
So Fitzcarraldo, there can be no forgiveness for it, even though.
No, there is forgiveness for it.
That's so it's not on your list.
No, I'm just saying if my list was good, it probably should be on it. Instead, what's on my list is number three, The Time Machine with Guy Pearce, which also killed a bunch of Indians, but that didn't bother me. What bothered me was I don't like these movies where I know – actually, all my movies are where I can't divorce myself from the source material, so you'll be bored by all three of them, Tom, because you don't care about source material at all. But like adapted to you means nothing.
Okay.
But, it's like in the book the time machine. He makes the time machine because he wants to, like, learn stuff and, like, explore time and just, like, further human knowledge. But then in the movie, they turn it into him trying to bring his wife back to life.
Ah, that resonates much more with modern audiences.
Yeah, screw science. So then he finds that he can't change the future, and she keeps dying in all these stupid Rube Goldberg ways, like Final Destination.
You're selling me on this movie, Kelly Wand, which I haven't seen.
Yeah. Okay, so then at the end, he goes forward in the future. This is part of it. This is a synopsis in a way. And he hooks up with this darker complected chick. And then she gets captured by these cannibals called the Morlocks, because in the future, cannibals rule everything, which we're already seeing happening now, like Idiocracy. But then he saves her by going into the future.
Kelly Wanda, I want to see Time Machine now. You've completely failed at making the case that there can be no forgiveness for this movie.
So if you're the white girl, you die no matter what.
Oh, I see that angle. Okay.
Right.
Now, I'm confusing this with there's a movie with Ed Burns where he travels around in time and, like, lizard apes take over the world.
Sound of Thunder.
Yes, with Ben Kingsley. Oh, yeah, that's right, based on Ray Bradbury's awesome source material, where you change the future by stepping off the path and catch a butterfly.
Right.
Ah.
Which they mangle into the time waves that they have to, like, duck around chairs, and it makes, like, jungles with those ripples.
And I forgot that was based on that Ray Bradbury short story. That makes it even more awesomely awful, doesn't it?
Yeah, I can't believe you know who Ray Bradbury is.
There's a building named after him from Blade Runner, so there you go. I think he also wrote some stories.
Adaptations, blah, 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 blah.
Good, so all right.
Time Machine, I left infuriated. I was infuriated by every scene. I was infuriated by every turn of the plot. I was infuriated by the acting. I was infuriated it got made.
Now, here's a question, Kelly Wand. Going into Time Machine, did you have any expectation that it was going to be somehow faithful to the source material?
In some, like, 1960 George Powell way, at least. Like, at least updated. Like, that movie's a classic compared to the remake.
Okay.
I'm sure you haven't seen it, though, because it was made before 1994.
Not only have I not seen it, I have no idea who George Powell is.
George Powell?
George Powell?
Powell.
P-O-W?
No. Powell is in the DVD type that you can't get.
P-A-L?
Yeah.
That's a dude's last name?
Yeah, George Powell. He's a pal.
Wow, I've got room to talk. This guy's a director?
Yeah, he made War of the Worlds.
Oh.
He made the Doc Savage movie. From the
there are Doc Savage movies? Okay, I didn't know there were those. Okay, well, I know the original War of the Worlds. That creeped me out as a kid. That made an impression on me.
See, so you're a George Powell fan.
I am a George Powell fan. I didn't even realize it. Okay, good.
So there you go.
Well, I
number three.
Okay, and he made a time machine. He made a 1960 time machine.
He made the one with Rod Taylor, the guy who played Winston Churchill in Inglourious Bastards.
Ah.
And he used, like, the hot blonde Eloy. And the themes of the book are actually explored a little. Like, the Eloy are kind of docile and vegetarian and weak, and that's why they die to the Morlocks. But then in the remake, they just died to the Morlocks because the Morlock are these big CG creatures that come out of the dirt.
Like the guys in Sound of Thunder.
It's one of those things where they go, there's always a speech about, oh, you just got to fight back, like in Alice in Wonderland, too. Like, she goes, there's got to be an uprising, but this has to happen first, and then it happens effortlessly. Same with V for Vendetta, where they just all put on the masks at the end.
It's all right.
Like this peaceful uprising that, oh, we just needed to get to the third act of the movie, and then everything's falling. Everyone changes their whole ideas about everything. Everything they believe in is completely different.
All right, good.
Thanks. Number three, Time Machine.
All right, Dingus, what is your number two movie that you're offended, that didn't necessarily offend you, but for which there can be no forgiveness?
Will you stop trying to change the category? All right.
By the way, real quick, Kelly Wand, what odds do you want to put that Dingus has Return of the Jedi on his list?
It'll be number one.
Because you know what? I'm thinking he might, because we already gave him some guff about it, he might, just to stick it to us, he might not have put it on his list. That's what I'm thinking. So I will bet you a nickel, Kelly Wand, that he doesn't put it on his list.
Well, you owe me a nickel for predicting Avatar was going to be Best Picture tonight.
We didn't bet on that, and I'm glad to be wrong. But will you take this bet right now?
I will bet you a nickel that both his other two movies are Star Wars movies.
Oh, well, I've totally made a nickel. He's not going to do that. He might make one of it, but I think he's not going to put it on there just because we gave him some grief.
All right, I'll take your bet. What's your bet? That either
the Return of the Jedi is one of his either number one or number two.
You're saying it is or isn't?
That it is. Oh, no, that it isn't, because we gave him Guff. I'm changing my mind.
Right.
I'm guessing
You're
that it
won't. Awesome at betting.
Hey, the over-under.
What's the spread on this guy?
Kelly Wine,
so bad at sports, he doesn't even know how to bet.
Like Kelly Wine, can you put 500 on the Dallas game for me while you're at it?
All
right. Okay, so no, I think he's not going to, because we said that he would, even though he wanted. Okay, here's my bet, for real. And I'm saying this for real. Normally, he would have put Return of the Jedi on there, but we gave him grief, so I think he's going to spite us and not put it on there. And so I'm going to bet a nickel that it's not his number one or number two.
Well, he had Jedi last week, so he wouldn't have it every week.
Right. So are you with me there or not?
Are we going to predict it's a different Star Wars movie.
All right. Okay. Well, we've laid out our predictions. We'll see how it goes. It doesn't have to be an exchange of money.
What? Bum, make it a dime.
Wow. Okay.
All right, let's hear it. Dime.
We'll argue over
who won afterwards.
Okay. Dingus, what's your number two?
For another hour.
Wait, am I still here?
I'm turning your mic back on. Dingus, he didn't hear any of that, Kelly Wand. I had a
I broke out of being on hold. I can't believe you guys wouldn't have picked one of the prequels. Return of the Jedi. Oh, come on. Do you want to go ahead? You want to start up with your whole bet based on the prequels now?
No, I just think that Ewoks bugged you more than anything in the prequels.
But everybody expresses rage through the internet. My rage wasn't anything in particular.
I just think but I don't think you're going to pick it though, because we gave you grief and no changing your list. You're a man of honor. I know you won't change your list.
I don't even know who's betting on what, so I can't.
I don't either.
Yeah.
So is your number two Return of the Jedi?
No, it is not Return of the Jedi.
But it's really. Give us a line and make us guess it.
I don't even know any lines from these because they so annoyed me that I wasn't going to bother to learn lines.
Wow, okay. I can give you a line from both of them, I bet.
Really?
Yep.
From both of what?
The movies that you're going to pick, your number two and your number one. So, by the way, that right now, because he can't give us lines, Kelly Wand, that means neither of them is Return of the Jedi. Because he can recite Return of the Jedi. Dingus, what's the first line in Return of the Jedi? The first thing.
What happened?
No. Do you know this? Can you say the first thing said out loud in Return of the Jedi? I don't think I could do it.
Do you know what it is?
I don't.
It's something. It's 3PO going, ooh.
Oh, is that true?
I think so.
Okay.
It's them on Tatooine, him going, oh, I smelled.
Oh, because they're going to the Jabba the Hutt's palace to rescue Han Solo. That's right.
Right.
Good, Kelly.
They have a complex plan, but he's acting like they don't. Because probably they flushed his memory again.
The poor guy.
Before they sent him to the planet.
All right, Dingus, give us your number two now that we know that I've won a dime from Kelly Wand.
Tom just called him poor guy, but he also called him the stupidest robot brain in another.
He is.
So now he feels sorry for the gay robot.
I just want to say, if Hansy is listening to this, he loves the 3x3 right now. All right, my number two movie that cannot be forgiven or offended by anybody with which is a movie called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And Tim Burton. Hey, well, I didn't even think of that. This is unforgivable because it's a remake that is unnecessary, and I'm really getting impatient with remakes that are unnecessary. I think of this like the cover of a really great song that reveals nothing new about the original song and doesn't even make a good song in making a remake. It reveals nothing about the characters that is interesting, and it takes a classic movie with an iconic performance, in my opinion, and reduces it.
So Tom owes me a dime.
Even more unforgivably, it takes a very good actor and makes him turn out a horrid and nonsensical performance. I really like Johnny Depp, and I find his performance horrid in this movie. Finally, I think I mentioned this when we were talking about Alice, and I'm not going to give any spoilers about Alice whatsoever, other than my opinion. And that's that he takes a work of strangeness
and he tries to explain it. And in the original film, Willy Wonka, which is a film I just adore, and it's weird. Willy Wonka is a film that's called Willy Wonka, and it's really about Charlie, this boy and this actor we don't really know, and the film was weird and wonderful and surreal, and I really love that movie. And Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is more about Willy Wonka, yeah. And I don't want to know anything about him. He should be an absurd mystery to me that has a sudden humanity at the end, which is perfect how it works for me.
No, his father's a dentist.
I don't want to know about his dad. I don't want to know how his dad acted. I don't want to know anything about his dad. And I just want to say to Tim Burton, stop explaining poetry to me. Just give me – don't even do it. There's no reason to remake Willy Wonka, and to remake it and make it so poorly and gloss it in that way is just unforgivable. And, you know, I had a couple other movies in mind for this list, but when I hit upon this one after how I felt about Alice, I couldn't let it go. So Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, moving on.
All right, I'm going to give you a line from the movie. You ready? Bubble gum is really gross. Bubble gum I hate the most. There you go. I told you I could give you a line from it.
You're right.
And I've got one for your number one movie, too.
I do, too. I have one from my number one movie, and I bet you probably have one from it as well.
Okay.
I forgive Charlie and the Chocolate Factory because a lot of kids get kind of fucked up in it.
Augustus Gloop falls in the chocolate river.
Ah, gotcha, fatty.
My number two is it's a couple reasons that there can be no forgiveness for this movie. I'm going to just cut straight to my main one, and then we can talk about how awful the movie is as well. That I don't necessarily have a problem with. In Spanglish, there's this idea that a poor immigrant woman who's trying to care for her daughter has the opportunity to go to a really good private school. This poor immigrant woman is a maid, and her employers offer to send her daughter to a really good private school that she can't normally afford. Well, the big decision at the end of the movie is, no, my daughter is not – it's going to remove her from being in touch with her cultural heritage, so I'm going to pull her out of this good school and not provide for her that way. Like, that's going to be bad for her, and she may not want this. She's going to resist the decision. It's going to really traumatize her, but ultimately it's for the best, which it's not. I just remember watching that stupid movie and at the end thinking, this is the sort of life-affirming final decision that she has to make. God, I hated Spanglish for so many reasons, but mainly that. There's this idea that the parent does something for the child based on the parent's own pride rather than what's good for the child.
Yeah. And because she slept with the dad, too.
She didn't, though. They did not consummate that relationship.
But she almost did. That's
well,
the same thing.
The whole movie
she
is
sex
so
with her eyes.
Yeah, and the whole movie is so stupid about the moral cause and effect between what people do. And also, by the way, anybody – I hope this is on YouTube. Just for an example, this could actually be a great 3x3, the worst sex scenes ever.
Oh,
I defy you to come up with a worse sex scene than the one between Tay Leone and Adam Sandler. It's like a sex scene written, directed, and performed by people who have never had sex and have no idea what it's like. Yeah. It's actually an amazing piece of work. If you can find that on YouTube, it's astonishing.
Yeah.
I think it's better in the context of the film. Don't let people off the hook here, Tom. Don't let them go see YouTube. Make them watch the whole movie.
Oh, I just...
Yeah. And then read my review on Sprocket Hold. It's the best thing ever last year.
That is an awesome review. I will say that.
And that was a reader request, if I'm not mistaken, right, Kelly Wand?
Yeah, a fan requested it.
Tom, I just want to say that if let's stipulate that we chose that 3x3 category and you won it because you win.
Oh, for worst sex scenes. Okay,
we should have winners.
By the way, Spanglish. So Spanglish was directed by James L. Brooks, who's a TV director. Came through like Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda and all those things, and he's done a few non awful movies. But my favorite bit of work from James L. Brooks. Do you guys remember Albert Brooks' Modern Romance?
Yeah.
James L. Brooks plays the director. In Modern Romance, Albert Brooks plays a movie editor. And he's working on a really crappy science fiction movie starring George Kennedy. And they actually have excerpts from the movie where he's trying to edit it. And it's George Kennedy yelling at people about being a bunch of weasels. And it's just ridiculous. Yeah. But playing the director of the movie, which is clearly represented as a terrible movie in the context of modern romance, is James L. Brooks, the actual director, playing this really milquetoast sort of weak-willed, uncertain movie director, which is the absolute wrong quality for a movie director to have. And Albert Brooks is, of course, making fun of this character in the movie.
And Sandler looks like Albert Brooks in Spanglish because he's got the frizzy hair and he's fat looking.
Well, my whole conceit, and I don't know if I've said this before on this podcast, a lot of times when I really hate a movie, I wonder why the director or writer is doing it, and I try to psychoanalyze them. So I think that Spanglish is all about some weird tryst that James L. Brooks had with one of his maids, and it's him trying to expunge his own sense of guilt for that.
So he considers himself the best chef in the United States of filmmaking.
Well, and substitute that for substitute that for being a movie director and reading reviews of his own movies. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe he was just trying to nail Paz Vega, which is a totally rational thing to want.
I could understand that. Yes,
he's a genius, and it's the best movie ever if he got her.
So I forgot, Kelly Wan, that I made you throw yourself on that particular grenade, but I'm grateful that you did watch Spanglish for me. That, by the way, true test of friendship. Anybody who, if somebody comes to you and says, Spanglish is awful, it's so awful, you should see how awful it is, and who then watches it.
I watched it twice to write that review. And
wow.
It's depressing that nothing else I wrote the whole year that I looked at and went, this is pretty good writing, except that review.
I'm kind of honored. I feel now like your muse.
Yeah.
But I've heard good things about your Tales of the Gold Monkey review. What was that? Was that last year?
Nah, it's not as good as the Spanglish.
All right.
Just read that and stop reading.
Tom, was James Brooks an editor or the director in that movie? What did you say?
So in Modern Romance, Albert Brooks is the lead character, and he plays a movie editor.
Oh, okay.
He's working on a science fiction movie that was directed by a character played by James Brooks.
Okay. But don't you think that the re-sewing of the clothes in Spanglish is an example of great parenting?
Wow, I forgot about that, too.
God. But the mom doesn't notice that.
First Leachman is drunk and wacky.
It's not even noon yet, Mom.
Oh, that movie's terrible.
Let's
and
watch
by the way,
movie.
So I watched that movie for a girl. The relationship's over. But one of the first, and it didn't break us up, but one of the indications that was a relationship that probably wasn't going to work out in the long run is I was told Spanglish is great. You should watch it.
Is that the chick with the yellow teeth?
It was not. I think it's either the Russian, but no, it was not.
Have you guys ever broken up with anyone over a movie? Because I've done it like six times.
I think Dingus and I feel similarly in that it's okay. There's nothing wrong with someone having bad taste in movies. I really don't hold that against
you. Then you got to sleep with them. How can you live with yourself if they don't like Dr. Strangelove?
You don't have to talk to them about movies.
You shouldn't if you want to keep it going.
So this is kind of cute. Dingus, Dingus, your wife, and I love Wendy. She's great. But Wendy has very different taste from you in movies. And does that ever cause any tension? I'm going to guess no, because you're so gracious about it. Am I right?
It causes tension in that after seeing a movie, I get so passionate about talking about it that she might leave a movie thinking she kind of liked it and get really annoyed with me when I start holding forth about all the things that were wrong with it, and she just wants me to shut the fuck up because she wants to keep liking it, and she doesn't want me to convince her that it was terrible. If it's a really bad movie, she knows it, but sometimes she just wants to like a movie, and she wants me to shut up, and I can respect that.
Did your wife see The Blind Side?
Can I take the fifth on this one?
You should have gone with her, Dingus. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when you guys are driving home after you had to sit through The Blind Side, and she loved it as much as I know she did. Kelly,
well,
what's
nominated for Best Picture? What did I tell you?
Are you serious? I knew that Sandra Bullock was nominated. Blind Side was nominated for Best Picture.
Of course, they could only choose from 10.
Yeah. Only 10 movies came out last year, Tom.
Kelly, what is your number two movie for which there can be no forgiveness at all? No way, never mind.
I'm going to do a line from it because there's so many good lines, and I predict, I bet you a nickel that Dingus won't get it. I am a person. My name is Anakin.
Oh, so you put it on your list.
Yeah, because I didn't want Dingus to steal
it. Do I get a dime or a nickel? What do I get?
Wait, that, so that's got to be, is that Phantom Menace? Or
there can be no forgiveness for Phantom Menace.
Okay. All right.
That's generally agreed.
I would be okay with sitting on the podcast and nerd raging, but I think we've done that. Can we just move on?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about it. I just want to get off the list.
Diggis, what is your number one movie for which there can be no forgiveness?
Is that really it?
That's the line?
No. Don't we get any more?
Oh, I don't. You know what? If you guys want to nerd rage,
if it's on your list, then by all means. But I.
So here's my thing. I am so over all that Star Wars stuff. It doesn't bother me. I'm not the least bit offended. George Lucas, I think, I mean, none of that matters to me. I honestly couldn't care less.
Yeah, in a way, I forgive him because he got me over Star Wars by making it. And now I don't have to ever watch Star Wars again. So thank you, George Lucas.
Thank you, George Lucas, yes.
Three movies for which there's much thanks for. I just wanted to preempt you, Dingus. I was trying to get into the competitive aspects of 3x3, because I think that's what the listeners want.
Well, there you can game the list, yeah.
More high tension, more acreage.
So, Dingus, give us a line from your number one. You said you had a line, and you said you're pretty sure I was going to come up with one.
All right.
They both have inky quills. Get it?
What? He's spoilerizing Alice in Wonderland again.
Yeah.
All right, my number one movie... There can be no forgiveness for which for. Here's a line from it for you jerks.
Tom, any predictions?
You know what? I think it would be a real jerk maneuver to try to preempt his list. So, no, I'm not going to predict it. I just wanted to give him some guff about Return of the Jedi because I was pretty sure he wasn't going to put it on his list. So, what do you got for us, Dingus? Give us a line.
All right, here's the line. And I apologize if I mispronounce it. Because I don't necessarily know how to pronounce this line. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani.
Oh, did you put another Paul Haggis movie on your list? Because I haven't seen In the Valley of Elah. Oh, no. Are you doing the Jesus movie?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I've never seen that, so I can't do a line.
Wait, Passion of the Christ?
You're damn right.
I love that movie. I totally just... I think it's a great movie. It's got a great sense of place, and the acting's good, and it's... horrifying and brutal, a brutal depiction of life in an ancient land and how depressing and gloomy it was living during then. It's a great movie.
Love that you're saying that, Kelly Wand, because you're making me want to see it. That's one of the few movies that I got from Netflix, and it sat here for the longest time, and I finally just turned around and sent it back. And I don't – maybe it was because you had such a negative reaction, Dingus. You might have.
I'm an atheist, and I think that movie's amazing. I think it's brilliant. I think it's a brilliantly told day in the life of a historical figure.
All right, well, Dingus, explain to us why there can be no forgiveness for Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ.
I was raised as a Christian and have moved beyond that, and I think it's a horrid film. I think it's unforgivable because not only to go with why I think the film is misguided in its making altogether, I think it's absolute crap, and I couldn't disagree with Kelly one more. And I think that's the dirty secret about this film, because beyond the fact that it's a misguided proposition to make it, in my opinion, and I'm not even going to speak to the whole idea of the anti-Semitism that was raised around it, because I'm ill-equipped to even speak to that, so I'm just going to put that off the table. I think it's poorly made.
You think it's poorly shot?
And I'm talking about it right now. Okay. And I think it's poorly shot. I think the lighting is terrible from a cinematographer named Kelb Deschanel, who should know better, even though he's made a lot of silly movies. And I think from that to the horribly cribbed score by a guy named John Debney that's cribbed from an excellent, one of my favorite scores by Peter Gabriel, the Last Temptation of Christ score. And this film just lifts that score and tries to shoehorn it into this film, and it's horrible. I think it's a terrible film. I think it is not very well made. And I can barely even speak to the acting because of how offended I was by it. And beyond what makes it beyond forgiveness for me is the overall way that this film was marketed and how it co-opted evangelicals into seeing it when they had no business doing so. And this is a craven political move, and I understand that it was done to get people to up the grosses for the film by a whole group of people, and that's fine if you want to force if you want to force this down people's throat. But churches went to see this film who had no business seeing it. And for me, who was raised in this faith, that I find this film to be utterly devoid of spirituality, and it's all about the physical. And this is, to me, it is gore, pure and simple. It's a gory film. And that is fine, and the gore is very well done for what it is. But I believe that evangelical Christianity is supposed to be about transcending that and about spirituality. And beyond that, on a personal level, and this is why this film lands in my number one of films that are unforgivable, because I think for me this is a personal moment. I have someone who's very, very close to me who is a Christian, who's an evangelical Christian. And at the time when we were going to see this film, or when this film was out, we were having pretty strong disagreements about different films. And she was very angry about Fahrenheit 9/11 being out. And I was very annoyed by Passion of the Christ. And we were both talking about two films neither of us had seen. And she finally said, look, you're not allowed to talk about Passion of the Christ because you haven't seen it yet. So don't even talk about why this film was made. And so we made a deal. You go see that film and I'll go see this film. We'll go into the theaters and we'll see this film and then we'll talk about it. And I held up my end of the bargain and I went to see Passion of the Christ. And so many people walked out of this film. You know, it was a partisan crowd to begin with, but a lot of people walked out. And I sat for the whole thing and I think it's horrible. But from a personal point of view, then I came out of that experience and let a couple of weeks go by and then wanted to continue the conversation. And she said, Michael Moore, I'm not giving him my money. So the person I made this deal with reneged on the deal, and I had to sit through this Passion of the Christ film, which I think is horribly made and I think was even nominated for Best Picture that year. And for all of these reasons, I find it to be an unforgivable film.
So I have two things I want to say. Kelly, you wanted to get in there a minute ago, though, so you can go first.
Well, sounds like your friend really Jewed you.
Ouch. I'm going to take over now. So the thing is, you say it's horribly shot and lit and stuff. Some of the things that struck me, even though I didn't care for Braveheart, I really liked Apocalypto, is that I felt like Mel Gibson had a really good sense for just the basic technical craft of filmmaking, and you didn't see that in Passion of the Christ.
I really did not. But part of this, Tom, I'm willing to allow that, and this is sort of getting into why I reacted to the way you started this list, is I was really, really offended by this film. And I found it to be an offensive undertaking as I watched it.
Well,
and that might have colored some of those reactions, but I do not deny that or I'm not going to back off on what I think about at least the music, but I don't really believe that it's as well shot as everybody thought it was. And I think it was nominated for Best Cinematography, and I don't think it's very good despite what Mr. Wand might think.
Did the fellow who – the cinematographer – he's not the same guy that did Apocalypto, is he? Because that was phenomenal cinematography, I thought.
I apologize. His name's Caleb Deschanel, and I don't know if he did that. You'll have to look it up.
So I'm curious, like, and again, I haven't seen it, but I know that I know it's been described as torture porn. But then I also know that the Passion of the Christ, the concept of the suffering that Jesus went through and what that means to Christians, that God would put his own son through that, that there's this, it's almost like a Christian version of the concept of catharsis in Greek drama. Do you just feel that has no place? Or, like, I can sort of understand why a devout Christian would want to depict the horrors of the pain a man named Jesus went through. So can you speak a little bit to that? Like, because I can understand why someone would do that, and you think that enterprise is wrong, or just the execution of it? Like passion plays, for instance, there's of course a long, long tradition of passion plays, which are simply a less graphic version of what Mel Gibson did.
Yeah, they? And he's a pretty devout dude. So
he's a devout Catholic,
right.
which is a different group of people than I'm talking about. And I'm not meaning to suggest, because I certainly don't want to offend anyone, that Catholics are not Christians. That's not what I'm trying to suggest here.
Okay.
But a whole group of Christians were co-opted into seeing this who were definitely not Catholics. I mean, busloads of people were taken to this movie who were definitely not Catholics.
Well, but Passion Plays aren't distinctly Catholic either, though.
No, but Mel Gibson is definitely coming from that point of view, and he's not going to agree with the things that evangelical Christians agree with. And so these two groups agree with definitely different things. His whole idea of the scripture is a different thing.
Can I ask Dingus real quick, is there anything in the movie, though, that's distinctly Catholic that you feel is unfair to evangelicals?
It's not that it's unfair. It's that from my point of view, from where I'm coming from and how I was raised, the point of this story is the victory, is the resurrection, and is the spirituality of it. It's not making it about flesh. And to me, when I was watching this movie, it is all about flesh. It is all about gore. It is all about suffering, and it is all about torture.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, in my opinion, offensive, because it is against the idea of Christ's spirituality and what his sacrifice meant spiritually and his victory spiritual. And what you get in the last shot of that, rather than sort of an understanding of the spiritual victory, is this weird sort of Terminator sort of shot of Christ. And you'd have to see it to understand what I'm talking about. But it just does not work. As far as I'm concerned, from a spiritual point of view, this story should be a spiritual story, and instead it's completely rooted in the physical, and I disagree with that.
Okay, but you understand, though, that is the tradition of passion plays and of Jesus' sacrifice. I mean, Jesus being fully man and fully divine, he had to experience and he felt all of that pain, all of the gore with the crown of thorns and being whipped, and the crucifixion is very much about the flesh.
I understand all of that.
Okay. And the audience
I think making us sit through that amount of torture and physical gore, it does nothing for me spiritually or physically. And I don't know what the point is of making that long of an ordeal. And I understand what you're saying about passion plays, and I understand the point they play within the faith. But that wasn't sort of the point of making this film. Or if it was, I just don't see that as being valuable, and I find it offensive.
And I really need to see this. I've got.
I think it's a great movie.
So Kelly Wand. So yeah, Kelly Wand, what you're saying, I really want to watch it now. Even Dingus, to sort of appreciate some of why you were offended by it. I now feel like
Aramaic and with subtitles.
Well, and so I remember that was one of the things that I was put off by. Right, and I think it's like over 2 hours long. It's a really long movie, and I remember all the controversy about Mel Gibson.
And it's an aspect of religion that I think is key to the story, like what you were saying to Dingus, is a lot of people were crucified over stuff like this, and this is what that felt like to live during that time, and this is what this person went through to make his point.
Well,
so
I think I
saw that as transcendent, like that he was willing to go through that. I'm sorry, go on.
No, that's okay. I disagree because based on particularly where I'm coming from, there was sort of a, for me, there was a total lack of spirituality, which really robbed the film of its point.
But you were ill-disposed towards this movie before you saw it. So when you did see it, was it about what you thought you were going to see? Like it was...
I think Dingus could manage expectations like that.
He was already mad enough to make this bet with his friend.
Well, I didn't make a bet. I was making a point about why I felt the film should be made, and we were talking about the controversy surrounding the film, and even I thought that some of that was unfair. And she basically said, well, you really can't talk to that because you haven't seen it. And I had to admit, yeah, you're right, I haven't. And she was making points about the Michael Moore film, and she hadn't seen it. And I said, I don't think you're being fair to that, so let's go. But any film that I go into, no matter how I feel about it, like I went into Alice in Wonderland, and I'm not going to give any spoilers, but I don't necessarily trust Tim Burton anymore. But any film I go into, I want it to be the best film of the year. I want to be able to put it on my list, and I want to be able to start building a list now. And I'm excited to go to almost any film, and it sort of starts with 100%, and I'm willing to let it go with that. And even Passion of the Christ, and like Tom said, Mel Gibson is a competent filmmaker, and I expected that level of competence, and I just didn't find that. Now, I'm willing to allow that my prejudices clouded my judgment, but I still found it offensive, and I find its making to be unforgettable.
All right. I can't wait to see this now.
I want your review of it, Tom.
All right, Dingus, you've sold it at least one rental. Nice work. All right, I'm going to move on to my number one. like I alluded before, I see a lot of crappy horror films. I recently rewatched, and I just thought this was such schlock. Actually, you know what? I didn't even watch it. I started watching it, and it got to the famous scene, and I was like, you know, I'm not going to watch this. And I just fast-forwarded a few of the scenes at the end, and it was just terrible. It was schlock. But in a way, it wasn't offensive because it was so stupid and transparent. I tried to watch I Spit on Your Grave, which is just...
Wow. The remake?
No, I don't think I Spit on Your Grave was ever remade. I Spit on Your Grave was... it's a sort of a Death Wish nod. You know, the Death Wish... Those vigilante movies are where the hero's wife is raped and his family is murdered, and then the rest of the movie is about him killing the people who did this. So I Spit on Your Grave opens with a... It's about a woman who gets raped and then kills her rapists. And I just couldn't sit through it. It was back in the 70s when you did these graphic rape scenes, and that stuff just makes my skin crawl. And I couldn't stick with it, so forget that movie. But it...
A remake coming out this Halloween.
Is there? Well, I'm not surprised, because the movie that actually I cannot forgive is, I think, far more offensive. Because, again, I don't necessarily find movies like that offensive. It's just schlock. I don't want to watch it. It doesn't bother me. Whatever. Let it be. I recently rewatched, and actually I'd never seen it before. I watched it because I found out it was based on an Ingmar Bergman movie. Wes Craven, I think it was his first movie, Last House on the Left, is a direct, not a direct remake, but it's clearly a remake of Virgin Spring. So hearing that once, I was like, what, huh? Wasn't Last House on the Left just one of those stupid rape revenge dramas? So I rented Last House on the Left, which is terrible, and then I rented Virgin Spring, which is fantastic. I mean, Virgin Spring, God, it's one of those things where you hear about a classic movie and it's sort of like a chore that you have to watch it, like eating broccoli. But you watch it and you're like, yes, of course it's classic. It's fantastic. So Last House on the Left so rips off Virgin Spring, but completely misses the crucial points of what made Virgin Spring fantastic, which are partly the cultural and religious context of it, but also the moral decisions and the calculus of what Max von Sydow decides to do and how tortured he is about it. Virgin Spring is about a girl gets raped, and her father has to decide... He's a devout religious man. He has to decide what to do once he discovers who the rapists are. And I encourage everyone, even if you're like black and white, Swedish, no famous celebrities who I would recognize, although you can't – Max von Sydow is so timeless. I heartily encourage everyone to watch Virgin Spring. There are so many cool things in that. But then Last House on the Left is Wes Craven thinking, okay, we're going to set this in modern day we're going to do like direct parallels to certain scenes, and it's just so amateurish and tasteless. And there's a remake of Last House on the Left, which is it pulls its punches, which is really stupid and unforgivable in its own way. But the original just has nothing to it, and it's surprising watching the original Last House on the Left and thinking, hey, this guy is going to go on to be a fairly stylish horror filmmaker. You know, he's going to do the last. Nightmare on Elm Street movies, at least a couple of them. And there's just no sign of that in the original Last House on the Left. There's a sign of some guy with no taste, with no decency, who saw Virgin Spring and didn't get it. And I just find that offensive.
So for the remake, are there other houses on the left after that house?
I'm not even sure. I think at one point she might say that that's where she lives, Last House on the Left. Hmm. That might even just be a stupid title they came up with. It's not even mentioned in the movie. So in the remake, by the way, they, of course, in the original, the daughter is raped and murdered. And by the way, in the Ingmar Bergman movie, that scene is so brutal without being graphic. And I just think that's an important distinction. And I love the way – I love and hate the way that is shot in the Ingmar Bergman movie. It's really – and I know that they had a tough time getting around the standards – board or whatever it was at the time. There's an excellent Criterion version of Last House on the Left with a great comic track. But and that distinction is completely lost in these crappy remakes where they just go for graphic.
Isn't I Spit on Your Grave the one where she cuts off the guy's penis in the bathtub?
Probably. I honestly, Kelly Wan, once it started just getting really gross, I just couldn't take it. And so I fast-forwarded to see, okay, there's going to be a murder here, and I could not tell you. I really think that that sort of schlock is unwatchable, but it doesn't claim to be inspired by Ingmar Bergman, so I can give it a pass. Which makes... So the original Last House on the Left is a movie for which there can be no forgiveness.
But Dingus likes it.
Dingus is above. I think Dingus is above seeing this kind of crap.
Mm.
To his credit.
Dingus is still trembling with rage right now.
I'm just shocked somebody actually watched I Spit on Your Grave again.
But I didn't really. I really couldn't.
He doesn't remember the scene I'm talking about, which is all I remember about that movie.
You mean the penis in the bathtub scene?
Yeah. That's the only thing I remember about it.
No, that's in Passion of the Christ, actually.
One, two, three. Wow. Tunk Tefrum.
All right, Kelly, what's your number one?
I guess Dingus just isn't as religious as I am. I think that's the obvious.
It's just that Monica Bellucci has other connotations for me.
Wachowski's, or whatever her name was. As I was saying, my number one, there can be no forgiveness. Okay, here's a line from it.
All right.
I give this murder a thumbs down.
That sounds really familiar. Dingus, do you know it?
I have no idea. The Incredibles?
Gosh, I don't... Have I seen it, Kelly Wan? Do you know?
It's hard not to see by act. You have to have seen it when it first came out. Jim Carrey, isn't it? Playing Axl Rose.
What? That's a Beverly Hills Cop guy.
Mm.
Isn't that Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills Cop?
Liam
Neeson. Axl Rose is from Beverly.
It's a Liam Neeson, Jim Carrey.
Oh, you know what? I'm thinking of Axel Foley, who did the music for Beverly. I don't. Oh, good lord! I wasn't even.
No, Axel Foley
did the music.
Character. Good lord.
Wait,
yeah,
who is Axel Foley?
Work. That's.
Shut up. Okay, let's clear up a few things.
The Foley artist named.
What? Who is Axl Rose? Is that the Guns N' Roses dude?
Yeah. Yes.
Is Eddie Murphy's name in Beverly Hills Cop Axel?
Yeah, Axel Foley.
Foley.
Yeah.
Okay, and what's the name of the guy that has that bump, 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 bump? Who is that dude?
Herbie Hancock.
Good lord, I don't know what I was thinking. Okay, carry on, Kelly Wan. Now that
but the name of the song is Axel F.
Ah, okay. I'm not a complete idiot. I'm a partial idiot. All right, so Kelly Wan, what? Jim Carrey plays Axel Foley. What? Where were you again?
Plays Axel Rose. Trying to think.
Man, I have no.
You can set yourself into a bonfire. We'll break out the marshmallows and the weenies, but you ain't going to be on news at 11. Memorable line.
I like your delivery of that.
It's Ventura.
Clint Eastwood?
A movie with Clint Eastwood and Jim Carrey? I don't think any such thing exists.
Very disappointed. Very disappointed in both of you.
Every Which Way But Loose?
No, that's a great movie.
I don't know what this is.
You know, as I was looking at bad movies, I thought, Kelly Wan's going to like this. Kelly Wan's going to like this. Kelly Wan's going to like this.
Yep. Anything with Christ in the title, I give it an 8 or above.
Yeah, I don't know your number one, Kelly Wan. You're just going to have to spill the beans.
I probably should have gone with Alien Resurrection, but instead I went with The Deadpool, the fifth Dirty Harry movie.
Oh, good God.
And Jim Carrey is in it?
Yeah, and there's it's the one with the toy car.
Charlie Sheen is in it, right? Or no?
No, that's The Rookie.
Does Charlie Sheen drive a toy car with a bomb in The Rookie?
No, he's small because he ate the brownie and then he drank the absinthe to drink me on it.
Stop.
What's wrong with The Deadpool? It's just a lousy, I remember there's
because
a space scene.
It's the last Dirty Harry movie we're ever going to get. And it's the last chance to make a good Dirty Harry movie, and it's that.
And there's a chase scene with a little remote control car. And does it have a bomb, or why is the remote control car dangerous?
Because it has a bomb in it, and they drive away from it instead of just getting out of the car. Like, they could outrun it with their much bigger car and bigger engine, or they could just go up on, like, the sidewalk or something, because then it couldn't. Instead, they have to use these convoluted ways to not beat it.
So why is this movie unforgivable? Is your number one unforgivable offensive movie of all time?
Well, that's all I had.
Kelly Wan, you're near and dear to Dirty Harry source material, I believe. I don't know if this is. Are we allowed to say that you could have been connected with a Dirty Harry product?
Yeah.
Okay. You were hired to work on a Dirty Harry video game that never got made. So you probably, in preparation, carefully acquainted yourself with the Dirty Harry oeuvre.
Yeah. So I had to watch them all, and then I got to Deadpool, and I'm like, oh, cool. The best thing about this game is I'll be able to redeem franchises from the Deadpool.
So it's kind of like Dingus having some preconceptions about Christianity. You had some preconceptions about Dirty Harry.
Right.
That affected
I was raised a certain way. And they were running around from that little car.
How do the Dirty Harry movies hold up?
He's a great character, but the movies are mostly lame because there's no villains in them that are really worthy of...
Oh.
I mean, maybe that's the point of them. Maybe it's just him... And everyone in it's just like a second banana to him. So it's kind of like a Mexican soap opera where you have like the bitchy main character. And then the rest are all just sort of reacting in orbit around her.
Are there any famous action sequences from Dirty Harry movies? Or is that not their bag?
The first one has him chasing the Scorpio killer around town and, like, running really hard.
That's a foot chase. Oh.
And he throws his badge in the water. That's an action scene. And there's, like, they fight a sawmill. Oh, yeah, and then the Enforcer, there's Alcatraz and some rocket launchers.
Whoa. It's like The Rock.
And then in Magnum Force, he kills them all by just driving around. And, like, they drive off the road because he's coming at them on a motorcycle.
He plays chicken with a motorcycle and wins?
Yeah, and then they go into the water, but they're dead because they just drove into the water.
What's the Do You Feel Lucky Punk one? That's a Dirty Harry thing, right?
Yeah, that's where he has a guy on the ground, though, and he's eating a hot dog.
He's eating a hot dog when he says, did I shoot six times or five times?
And he gets upset if his friend eats hot dogs with ketchup on them. Makes him crazy in Sudden Impact.
That makes Dirty Harry sound kind of wacky. Is he wacky?
Yeah, he's dirty and crazy.
All right, okay, good.
Yeah.
And so there can be no forgiveness for the Deadpool. So you know what, Kelly Wand? I'm sure that if you wait long enough, someone will dig up and do a remake with another actor.
No, irreplaceable.
Okay.
Who could fill the Dirty Harry?
Charlie Sheen.
Ugh.
Jim Carrey.
So Jim Carrey has a bit. Is it a bit part in Deadpool? Is it just like
He's a heroin addicted. He does an Axl Rose video, so it's like he's doing a cover song of Welcome to the Jungle. They're doing shooting a video of it. Liam Neeson shooting the video, and then everyone on the set keeps dying, like on Scream.
Oh my God!
So the Deadpool's like, I know it's a wretched movie, and it just keeps disappointing. It's just a piece of shit.
Should we implicate a particular director? Do you know who did it?
Buddy Van Horn, a friend of Clint Eastwood's.
Ouch. Okay.
See, if he'd done it, it would have at least been Gran Torino good.
No.
I know Tom likes Gran Torino.
Oh, good Lord.
He likes the song.
Oh, good Lord. All right, good. So there we go.
Deadpool. My number one.
Those are nine movies from us for which there can be no forgiveness.
This podcast was longer than the Oscars, and no matter what year you're listening to this podcast in, the Oscars are still on right now.
So, Dingus, what do you got for us next week? It's your responsibility to come up with a 3x3. Go.
All right. My 3x3 for next week is sort of a commemoration of the winner of Best Picture for this year's Oscars. Avatar. Why not?
So you're going to commemorate Hurt Locker. Good. I like this one already.
All right, this is, and I'm going to try to avoid the swamp I fell into last time I did this, because I was going to use the same wording, and that was I was going to use the words best depiction, but I'm gonna say best equaling favorite, or however you choose to use the word best / favorite, okay? So a depiction of soldiers in film. Right. So you can choose it to be best meaning good or favorite depiction of soldiers in film.
Do Vikings count?
I think you could go there.
You can game it however you want, Kelly Wand. You can say Phantom Menace if you want, or the Deadpool for that matter.
Good. All right. So join us for that next week, our 3x3 best depiction, best / favorite depiction of soldiers in film. And we will also be discussing the latest Matt Damon, Paul Greengrass collaboration, Green Zone. I am Tom Chick, and I'm here with Christian... Mertis?
Murtaugh. That's great. Murtaugh. Murtaugh. Murawski.
And Kelly Wand.
Getting too old for the shit. Because Poe wrote on both.